And a very big aloha. I'm Cindy Palos here with Eddie Garcia. This is Living Earth Systems Radio Show. And I have to say, Eddie, I am just thrilled to be here with you today. In fact, I think I'll go Facebook Live so people can watch if they go to Cindy Palos, because we're going to be talking all things really exciting about gardening. Eddie, we're going to start with a little bit of information about you, because I just love what you've been doing. Of course, people can also go to your website. I'm going to give it now in the beginning and also as we get through this, because your website also has tons of great information and videos that you have there where people can find out. They go to livingearthsystems.com, that's right?
Correct.
So you know a lot of people I know, and I heard about you from Marty Dredd and some other people, and I was excited to find out that you're doing amazing things, things people may not even know is possible with what you're doing with your Living Earth Systems, including, well, the thing that blew my mind you told me about, with earthworms that eat plastic. Is that true, really?
That's actually a beetle larva that eats plastic, but yeah, it's like a worm for sure.
It's a beetle that eats plastic.
It's a larva of a beetle that eats the plastic. Yeah, very interesting. Surfer Magazine did an article on that years ago. We're working on a provisional patent so that we can provide it to the world without someone tying it up.
You know, that plastic's one of the biggest problems right now in the earth and in the oceans and everything. But if that could really happen, that kind of blows my mind. It's just like, wow. Tell me about you. How did you get interested in doing work with the earth?
So from the very young age, being around nature and close to things that are around me, I was into reading a little bit when I was really young. And one of the first books that I ever read was The One Straw Revolution. It's about an old Japanese man that changed the farming industry on wheat by not actually tilling the soil, by laying the grass back down and allowing the earthworms to bring the nutrients back down into the ground. I think it was a fairly famous book, like in the 70s. You can find it somewhere, The One Straw Revolution. That led me to other things like Darwin's Notes on Earthworms. Who even knew Darwin wrote a book about earthworms?
I had no idea.
Yeah, so being inspired by the possibilities and also by growing up here in Hawaii, seeing how the ancient Hawaiians had a perfect agricultural system from the mountain down to the sea. Everything was kind of taking care of itself and dependent upon each other. So those were like really good inspirations for me to just try to mimic in what we do with regenerative agriculture.
There's amazing amounts of beautiful history of how Hawaiians did this and kind of passed it on. I'm friends with a wonderful guy you probably know, George Kamoko.
Yes.
Yeah. And he loves his ranches. And then there's some other wonderful ones. I'm sure you know the guy that's the Sprout guy that has been working with Sprouts and the earth here for a long time. So there's a beautiful tradition of taking care of the earth. But somehow with the growth and what's happened with the changes in the time, we know what happened to a lot of the land here on Maui. So you decided to take your passion for the earth and for worms. I got to get a close-up of your T-shirt. Says, support global, not warming, support global worming, worming, right? So all of a sudden when you decided, well, what about if we take this idea of how the natural process in worms get us back to the original meaning of how we can do things naturally? And I mean, you've done this in lots of different ways, but tell me how you actually started practicing what you've been reading about.
So I had good examples right out in front of me, the taro patch, the mm-hmm. lo'i, if you will. Mm-hmm. The water runs into it.
Yeah.
I started to throw fish in the upper lo'is and realized that it actually gave nutrients to the taro down below it, sort of like what people call aquaponics. So I had invented types of aquaponics 30, 40 years ago, before the invention of aquaponics, yeah, realizing that everything can work in unison. When I look at a stream, the trees dropping their leaves and the fish that are in the stream, uh-huh, they're all doing a trade-off and they're feeding each other. Uh-huh. So that's where the term I've kind of coined as living earth systems. Mm-hmm. A forest is a perfect living earth system.
Yeah.
It drops the leaves, the worms eat it into fertilizer, which in turn takes care of the trees and all of the creatures in the forest. So if we can make agriculture look like that, and we can mimic what nature is doing and work really within her systems, that's why I mentioned the ancient systems that the Hawaiians had in place from the mountain all the way down to the ocean.
Yeah.
There was consciousness about how it was done and what we used for fertilizer and whatnot. So that for me, as well as seeing really bad examples of agriculture left here on Maui, Molokai, all the islands through the pineapple industry and through the sugarcane industry.
Mm-hmm. They killed the earth.
They've left areas just completely decimated, yeah, where there's nothing in the soil. It's just basically an inert medium.
So let's bring it back to what you're calling the show and what you do, living earth system. So explain what a living earth system is to you. What is a living earth system?
A living earth system is reestablishing the life in the lower and all the dimensions of the soil, from the top where the leaves drop to 10 feet down where the mycorrhizal cultures spread out a web that actually allows the trees to communicate with each other, uh-huh, and take nutrients from where they need it. A great example, in an attacked forest with a great mycorrhizal fungal system underneath it, a tree in the shade can actually receive photosynthesis from a tree in the sun.
Wow.
Almost like the old movie, The Avatar.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, yeah.
Everything is connected.
Haven't they found this with mushrooms as well, about the fungi?
So what I'm talking about, a mycelium, is actually the body of a mushroom. The mushroom is only the tiny little fruit we see.
Mm-hmm.
So we see this tiny little fruit that comes out of this giant web that lives underground and connects everything. When we till the earth really deep and we upset that, then we've kind of unbalanced the natural system that's in place.
I just say hi to some people on Facebook. Tulsi, thank you. Tulsi, she's in Australia, I believe.
Cool. Aloha,
no,
Tulsi.
Is she Australia or are you in South Africa? And also Larry Michelle, good to have you there. I am streaming on Facebook if you're listening on the radio, so you can see Eddie's face. Eddie, by the way, is passionate, really passionate about this because you've seen it work. I've never known anyone that loves worms as much as you do, Eddie. you're a worm lover. South Africa. Tulsi's in South Africa. But, I mean, you saw the purpose and the value of the worms, right? In working.
I do. And a lot of people might just say worms, but worms are the one that everybody can wrap their head around. A lot of people are into earthworms right,
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
We use about 4 or 5 different species of earthworms here on Maui.
Ah.
But there's a whole myriad or a whole group of other creatures that we use. Amphipods, copepods.
I don't know what they are.
Isopod is a roly-poly.
What's a roly-poly?
So the little bugs that roll into
a ball when you
lift the rocks up.
Yes.
There's millipedes and centipedes and, yeah, things that you wouldn't really think. You, yeah, might think of them as a pest.
Yeah.
But they all have their role in nature. They're breaking down material that falls from the trees, animals that die, manure that gets left on the ground. They mix that all up. They break it down. And that's how we feed the ground.
You've got to tell me some reason for centipedes, guys. I always thought there was no reason for a centipede. And I don't like killing things, but I've been known to kill a centipede or two. What is the reason for a centipede?
So they actually play a unique role within the composting system. They are actually predators, and there's some insects that may say, for instance, there's a fly going to come in and he's going to lay some eggs that would make maggots,
oh,
or that would make it go anaerobic without oxygen.
Oh.
He might take out some of those predators and help balance the whole situation out.
Amazing.
What we're really constantly trying to find with what's below and what's above is, uh-huh, a balance.
Wow.
And what we've really done is we've sort of knocked things out of balance. So trying to restore that order is part of what we're trying to do with Living Earth Systems.
Well, I was going to your site and I saw that you had a beautiful post on your site about how anyone can create a living earth based on carbon, right?
That's right.
And how much of an area, you said you could do, how much of a living earth?
It all depends. What you're probably referring to one of our classes that's online, and it's,
yeah,
how to create a cubic yard of soil.
That was it.
So that is a cubic yard of soil using kitchen scraps, cardboard, a little bit of sand, leaves from your yard. And this term yard waste, everyone is taking the leaves and the lawn clippings and it's going to the dump. It's turning into gases in the atmosphere. We can save that and put it in a convenient little box in our backyard, feed it to the earthworms, and they will turn it into rich soil. We can feed our mango trees or our roses or what have you.
What, when you found this out about how important carbon, let's go through carbon and say how beautiful the whole system is when you're working with it, the value of creating carbon.
So, you know, carbon is I think it's a little misunderstood by people.
It is
basically the building blocks of life. I believe we're 18% carbon ourselves.
18%?
Yes. So all living life on the planet are carbon-based creatures, meaning that their basic structure is carbon. That can be mixed with water, with minerals, with different molecules that are not necessarily carbon-based to create a whole. So when we also think about carbon in the atmosphere, that's what we're talking about when we talk about global warming.
Yeah.
Plants have the unique ability through sunlight and photosynthesis, when the carbon actually hits the leaves of the plants, the plants turn that into sugars. Thus the word carbon, carbohydrates, there's a similarity there. So they pump these sugars into the ground.
Wow.
And as these sugars are getting pumped into the ground, microbes and different creatures that live in the ground actually turn them into beneficial components of the soil.
So the earth is a sugar addict too.
It sure is. Actually, basically, the earth and the creatures on it, the plants and algae in the ocean, basically take sunlight and turn it into sugar and feed this giant, let's look at it as a sugar powdered donut.
I feel so much better about sugar. It gets such a bad rap.
It sure does, doesn't it?
It does.
I love sugar.
Isn't that interesting that the earth feeds on and loves that sugar?
Yeah, let me tell you something about sugar that's really interesting. So one of the things that we do at our farm stands is we serve fresh squeezed sugarcane juice. Now, a sugarcane plant...
Now, let's back you up. Your farm stand is at?
We have one of our farm stands is at Launiapoco. And we have some others that aren't open right now, so we'll kind of focus on that one. It's by the Launiapoco Beach Park. You can find us there. We run some educational classes out of that piece of land, and also we serve some things at our fruit stand. We also give food away to our community through that fruit stand.
Wonderful.
For people who cannot afford buying some good, delicious vegetables and fruits from us.
That's amazing. And Launiapoco, for people who are just kind of passing through and don't live here, is at?
The bottom of Kaihelekū on the west side of Maui, right before you get into Lahaina, by Launiapoco Beach Park.
You
can find it on the map.
Yeah, you can find it there.
So
I didn't know you had a stand there. Now, you also own land over at Maliko Gulch, which you've been working very, very... Maliko Gulch is on the way right there towards, you know, when you get past...
I do not own the land. Oh, okay. I lease the land, and I'm a steward of the land, trying to right some of the wrongs that have been done. So I want to mention two things really quick.
Yeah.
Just a real quick note on the sugarcane. Because we grow it instead of as a giant monocrop, each plant is worth about $1,000 a year a plant for us. And that plant will last for 16, 17 years.
What?
In the sugarcane industry, that plant was only good for a year. Then they burn the field, and it was probably only worth 50 cents a plant. So we want to like turn farmers on to the economics of like a different way of doing it and trying to actually take it from the farm all the way straight to the customer.
So is that the reason they take it down? Is it takes too much room or space up? What was the reason for taking it down too soon? Just not wanting to wait that long?
It was all about economics because they were growing it in a massive scale, and the way that they harvested with large trucks, it all got thrown in dirt, leaves, plastic, everything, and thrown in a boiler. At a central facility, and then it would just be boiled down into a liquid and the sugar components would be extracted out of it.
So what do you do with your sugar
cane? So for us, we grow a sugar cane as an island with other trees and other plants. Pua olena, which is a native turmeric. We grow sugar cane, papaya, and either ulu tree, coconut tree, either one of the voyaging plants or some of our native plants here around with what we're growing, so that the sugarcane itself has a value as making our own sugar at the farm or serving it as a fresh squeezed sugarcane juice, while at the same time the island that it grows in provides food for many years to come and multiple harvests of different species within one area. This is very different from a monocropping operation where you look in a field and you only see one of the same thing over and over and over again.
So that's not necessarily good, right?
No, it's not. It displaces the bees. It displaces the animals.
I didn't know that.
There's drainage issues. There's soil into the sky issues. We could go on and on and on about that all day. But what I really want to focus on is the positive things that we are doing. We see enough of the destruction out there around us.
Yeah.
And with regenerative education centers, we build working models that are doing it the right way. We can bring people in. We can share with them how we do it, which allows them to understand. We like to say we create ambassadors of stewardship because we teach them how to be better stewards by showing them working examples where everything is working and happening.
Well, you do have classes that you
have. We do have classes. You can find some of those online. You can find us on Instagram through Living Earth Systems.
You have good videos on.
Yeah, we create films to educate the larger public. So the education centers serve our community here. But by documenting that, we're actually able to reach the world and make differences all over the place. For which actually brings me down to one of the main reasons that we're here is actually to promote our nonprofit.
Yes.
Which is Regenerative Education Centers. That's recenters.org. Right now, we've partnered up with another nonprofit called Sea Trees. And Sea Trees, they basically take care of watersheds, coastal ecosystems, and coral reefs all around the world.
What is a living tree?
A sea tree.
A sea tree.
The Sea Tree Program is basically a program by Sustainable Surf, a nonprofit, and they plant mangroves all over the world in areas that the mangrove estuaries have disappeared.
Uh-huh.
And in some areas, they restore coral reefs. Here in Hawaii, mangroves are invasive for us.
Yeah.
So their program with us is what we do with regenerative agriculture, planting native plants along the stream beds and hitting the erosion lines to keep soil out of the rivers and off the reefs.
Uh-huh.
So we partnered.
Can the soil damage the reef?
So, yeah, a lot of people don't realize most of our damage on the reef is not only from the sun and what they call bleaching of coral, but there's much more damage here in the islands from erosion. Water gets into the stream because it's not, the system isn't really maintained. And that comes out and it settles on top of the reef and basically smothers them. And so we've lost, they say, as much as half of our coral reefs due to bad management of runoff and erosion here on the islands.
What would the natural way for that runoff to be?
So in a natural system, we have rains, and those rivers put out a bunch of water into them.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, it will take some sediment, usually organic sediment that's floating because the streams have run so much.
Mm-hmm.
But with the introduction of, you know, a lot of things, really bad agriculture, which tilled these giant mountains into fields and left all the soil open for the rain to hit, and then it just runs downhill into the ocean. Not only that, bad construction sites that aren't really managing it outright, as well as feral pigs and deer and some of the other invasive species we have here on the islands. All of that contributes to chaos within our stream systems and our watershed. Yeah, it's pretty crazy, and I think a lot of people aren't really aware of it, but I would say a huge, I don't want to give percentages, but a huge amount of the damage that we face within our reef system and our streams and losing land to the ocean and to the sky is directly related to, you know, things that we have to bring back in balance.
Well, let's get down to the reality of what we hear all the time of the problem with global warming, not global worming.
Yeah, that's a solution.
The problem with global warming, the problem with what we've been doing, you know, in the sake of trying to make things easier, faster, using chemicals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When you start seeing and try to teach people what to do that helps solve this, do you feel like you're trying to push that big rock up the hill, or how do you feel about this huge situation of the fact that we're in a crisis right now and there's a lot to be done and trying to get this to be changed?
Well, this is our part in what we can do, because I've been a student of nature for so long. I almost kind of help people speak its language a little bit.
Ah.
And when we understand that there's some really simple things we're doing that can be changed, and we show them a working model, and then we work with them and we give them solutions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different solutions on so many different levels. Mm-hmm. For instance, kind of a funny one, we grow what's called a loofah sponge. And we talk to people about, hey, you know that blue plastic sponge in your sink, every time you use it, little pieces of that are breaking off and going down the drain.
And those will make their way out to the ocean.
So we turn people on to loofah sponges, which they can grow. When it's young, it's a great food. It's known as a Chinese okra. It's a beautiful plant with flowers on it.
You can eat the
loofah. You can eat the loofah when it's young, and it's really incredible. We serve some, I think, at our last farm-to-table dinner. So also something that you can grow for food. And now that loofah sponge, I've been using them in my sink exclusively.
Yeah.
I have sponges that are going on 6 months. They're way less gross than the kitchen sponge because they're antibacterial.
Do you sell those?
We do. We sell them at our farm stand. And we also give people seeds so they can grow them on their own.
Wow.
So turning people into, hey, throw a few seeds on the bottom of your fence. Now your fence is going to be covered with a beautiful vine that you can eat and wash dishes with.
That's amazing.
Just little simple examples. There's so many things that we do on our laundry. Not putting a filter on your laundry machine. Imagine everything that's just going right into the ground out of our laundry. Kind of trying to turn people on to some simple soaps that are a lot better for the environment and work fine for their clothes.
Uh-huh.
So Regenerative Education Centers is all about a lot of this stuff other than just agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
500 million. Coffee cups and lids a day.
500 million?
Yeah, so bring your own coffee cup.
Yeah.
Little things like this can actually make great changes when we're all doing it together.
Yeah.
And so for me, the idea of being able to share some of this knowledge with people, I say the time has never been riper because people really want to make a difference.
Oh, yeah,
and it's
they do.
Overwhelming. There's so many different directions to go. What should I do? What's really making a difference?
Yeah. But you know one thing that happened during COVID over the last 2 years? Gardening became a huge thing. There were more people gardening over the last couple of years than ever before. And when you go to your site, livingearthsystems, is that .com?
Yes, correct.
livingearthsystems.com. You bring up some wonderful points in there that are basic things that everyone, anyone, even me, can use to actually understand how to garden the right way and get results that are even better than you might imagine, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like we have, we can show you on site on some of our projects. We have one site on the west side of Maui where we've been growing food there no longer than 11 months. Mm-hmm. And we've already given away to our community over 40,000 pounds of food.
What?
Like ridiculous.
What?
We have banana trees that are 8 months old that have 13 keikis underneath them and 100 pound huas of bananas on them.
In 11 months.
And how's really that? Consistency. Observation and patience. Those are the three things. Piling some stuff up in a pile, putting a water line on it, throwing some earthworms in it, being patient enough, throwing some fungi material in it, and then we've created this fertility hub.
Where do you get the fungi material?
So because I've been building farms all over Maui and in the islands for several years, I have stash pots all over. In Maliko, I think we have about 180 acres we're managing.
I'm picturing your house with a section of one room with worms,
So we have quite a bit of area. And those areas have been made available to me because of my track record of farming and trying to share with people what we're doing. So we've taken some places that are up front and center and that Maliko really needed the help.
Mm-hmm.
Maliko has been used as a dump for the last 100 years.
Oh, gosh.
And, it's so bad that the name Maliko is known in the Hawaiian language, the modern Hawaiian dictionary, as to discard or to dump.
Oh, no.
If you dig further into history down in Bishop Museum, you find that the word Maliko actually means to bloom. It's a north to south valley.
Wow.
So we are like represented with the opportunity to help it bloom again.
Mm.
And that's really magic, seeing Maliko when it used to have so much going on in it and knowing what comes out of that stream. I would say we pulled over 100 tons of metal and trash out of the stream down there.
Wow.
And we've replanted the sides of the watershed with native plants. We've taken invasive plants out, turned them into wood chips, fed them to earthworms, which are now feeding native plants. So, and a lot of food growing down there.
Yeah. If you go to your website, you see you holding this really rich earth. But I have to say, I just was raised where the worms aren't going, I don't know if I can hold it with all those worms in there. Because, just in our movie, it was like, oh, my God, worms are yucky. But you're holding it. And, again, the reverence you have for worms shows that you understand the nature of worms. Let's explain a little bit more about how worms do their work, since you have a passion for worms like no one I've ever met before, Eddie.
Yeah, so let's start off with the earthworms. We might get into the mealworm eating beetle larva afterwards. The earthworms basically, there's four or five different types of worms. Some of them are known as leaf litter worms, which you know as the red composting worms.
Yeah.
Some of them are what's known as a manure worm, meaning they eat poop. And some of them are deep dweller worms, which actually go as far as 20, 30 feet down in the soil.
Wow.
Some of them build vertical tunnels that are permanent. Some of them build horizontal tunnels that are not so permanent. They have one thing in common. They all eat each other's poop. And in doing that, they trade their gut bacteria, they trade beneficial microbes, they trade fungal material. And then when, say, for instance, a leaf litter worm poops on the surface under the leaves from some leaves he ate, the deep dweller comes up and grabs that, brings it down into an 18-foot tunnel, and then poops it out down there. Now this humic acid that was in the leaves is breaking down the rock material very deep. Not only that, there's a trail of the fungus behind the worm, which helps to establish that mycorrhizal web we talked about earlier. So the worms are an integral part of the avatar, if you will. Saying that they're able to spread it, trade it amongst each other, and they're attracted to each other. A lot of people don't realize that.
No.
So they keep them in a bin by themselves. They'll find out if they put their bin on the ground, some of their worms will escape. But if they keep it just healthy enough, other worms will come back in it from deep in the ground. And then to set an environment where they can live and they can create fertility within that area, that's the way that it works.
How do you keep worms? What do you have to do how do
you
feed them?
So, you know, there's a bunch of different ways. I know a lot of people with a small little bin right underneath their kitchen sink.
Huh.
And they take all their food waste and
really,
they simply...
Literally in the house,
right
under
in their
the
house,
sink.
Two little tier bin. And in this bin, they put their food scraps, their carrots, their onions, or salad scraps. And these worms eat it right into black soil, right underneath their sink.
Wow.
With a lid and a screen on it, no smell.
Well, you keep the... You do put earth in there first with
no,
the
you actually...
You
just put shredded newspaper in there, and they turn the shredded newspaper and your food scraps into rich living earth. It's amazing. Yeah, it really
is. They turn newspaper into earth.
That's right.
How does that happen? I can't
even
imagine.
So if you think about it, newspaper was a tree.
Oh my
basically
gosh.
Cellulose material. And they do just like they do in nature. They break it back down into, you know, usable material.
I'm learning so much from you. Folks, in case you're just tuning in, I'm talking to an amazing man. Eddie Garcia started the Living Earth Systems. You can go to livingearthsystems.com. This will later be posted. This whole interview will be posted if you missed some. And I do thank our Facebook people here, you know, John Lundgren, Patience Parker, Lloyd Trafton, Tulsi. I love you, Tulsi. Hi, Tulsi in South Africa. So, I mean, we're learning a lot here. We are really learning a lot about the earth. And I guess a lot of us have been not... Wouldn't you love it if some of this was taught in schools? I know you know about what they have been doing in some of the schools here on Maui, where they've been teaching some of the children to actually have a class in growing produce in the school, at the school system, and then other places. And the children have been loving it because they plant things and they grow. And I would love to see this spread more and more like it's a regular thing. You've heard about that, right?
Yeah, we bring in some schools once in a while, and we're about ready to start gearing towards that a lot more as we get the word out. Lately, we've been bringing in private homeschooling groups, 20, 30 kids.
Really?
We've been keeping it to like 10 kids at a time, outdoor environment, so everybody's got a lot of distance in between them. And we're able to teach them right there on site, getting their hands in the worms. And it's really amazing. You can see some of that on our Instagram, what we're doing with some of the kids. And we do realize this is probably the first ad or the first time we're really going to speak public within this community. We've been doing stuff all around the world. I have been. And I haven't really spread it too much out within my own local community.
Yeah.
But now's the time for us to really get it out there because we're set up to do it, to bring in schools, to bring in any group who wants to come and learn about what regenerative agriculture is. Then we're here to share it with you.
How do people who are doing homeschooling, because there's more now than ever before, obviously, how do people find out about having their child part of your classroom?
Basically? You can go to our nonprofit site, which is Regenerative Education Centers, recenters.org.
Recenters.org.
Because Regenerative Education Centers was too long to put out there.
Recenters.org.
So you can go there and you can simply contact us on there and tell us that your school wants to come for a visit or what you want to do, and we will do that for you. We'll, that's what we're into right now, is really spreading the word. And as I said before, maybe trying to help a little bit create ambassadors of stewardship.
You know, a lot of people say, I can't garden. I don't really have a big space. You know, a lot of people are in limited spaces. I don't have enough space. What do you say to people about that?
So if I had a dollar for someone every time someone told me they don't have a green thumb, we all have a green thumb. Mm-hmm. We just don't know it. So we need to help you learn yourself. Mm-hmm. Basically, we create gardens in inner cities out of we have an aquaponic system made out of trash on the farm that we use as our demonstration. But I built aquaponic systems all over the world, in some of them in areas where they're trapped in the middle of a city in a parking lot, and we're producing thousands of pounds of food on top of asphalt.
My gosh.
By literally having the fish in a tank and growing the food, sort of. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with aquaponics.
Yeah.
But it's like growing food.
I think they know about it through marijuana.
Oh yeah, well, I think that's more hydroponics. Hydroponics uses a chemical substrate.
Ah.
It's not super good. It doesn't have real great nutrient density values, which a lot of people are unaware of. But aquaponics is living creatures. So there's some fish in a tank, bunch of other creatures. They're pooping in there. They're running through some plants. The plants are basically a filter for the fish. So now you have fish to eat and you have plants to eat, and everybody's helping each other.
And you don't even have to have an aeration system.
All part of it. So it's built with an aeration system.
Uh-huh.
I have one right now that just runs off a little solar panel in the sun. Wow. I don't do hardly any maintenance to it.
And what kind of fish do you use?
So I use tilapia, as well as what I'm really gearing towards here in the islands. We had tilapia available to us, and a lot of people like to eat that, but we've been gearing our systems towards actually using native fish, mm-hmm. like oopu and oholehole mm-hmm. and mullet.
We're talking real fish,
but we're also talking little fish. You can do it with a few guppies. You can do it with koi in your pond,
really,
and tap that into your landscape or into a garden above ground that you can grow food. So being able to, like, aquaponics has really made it where you can grow food out in space. They're actually using it. They're using a little more hydroponics up there because of the fish issue and everything like that. But there's places all over the world where they're having successful aquaculture with a byproduct of tons of food grown for it that is the filter system for the aquaculture.
It's amazing.
So the more, and we're wide open in the state for money coming in for aquaculture, and we want to get more people inspired.
Uh-huh.
I really want to gear people towards using our native species
rather
than species that have been brought in.
Yeah.
But you have to start somewhere. And so even for people to have a few goldfish in their tank and learn how to put a basket on it and grow some herbs for their kitchen, there's always a starting point to get people involved.
Wow.
And I think everybody has a green thumb if we follow these rules. Observation, patience, and consistency.
That's are all good things for anything, right?
Yeah. Some people argue. A guy says, I watered it every day. I was so consistent. And I was like, well, did you notice that it was drenched and it smelled bad? No, I didn't. I'm like, well, that's the observation part,
right?
You know what I mean? So
that's where you say they talk to you. You said the plants talk to you.
So when I say teaching people the language of nature, through our observations, we see patterns.
Uh-huh.
And these patterns will speak to us if we're listening.
Uh-huh.
If we see the leaves all drooping, we might think it needs water. But if we notice that it's still so wet, the leaves may be drooping from root rot.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the things we learn to interpret. And when I talk about speaking the language of nature, it's this time that you put in, this consistency, this observation that allows you to sort of speak its language. And that's what stewardship is, really learning to speak the language of the land around us.
And let's talk about, because this is very interesting. I've known a lot of people who've done work and actually done soil sampling from around the island. We're unique here on Maui. Of course, you got a lot of lava, you got a lot of sand, depending on where you are. How much do you have to know about your different areas to work with this and how each area reacts? Obviously, something in the sandy area near the ocean is going to be different than maybe in a lava, close to a lava area, versus something way up country in Kula. How do you work with all the different kinds of earth?
So that has taken like observation and watching and learning these different systems. Fortunately for you out there, the audience, you can come learn what we've learned over the last 50 years here. And through my observations, where I have a demonstration on the north shore of the island, which is really wet, and everyone's like, oh, you can grow anything there. And then I bring them to the farm that's only been up running 11 months in the desert, where when we started, it was a pile of dust. And it was really bad. And in the 11 months we've been working there, like I said, 40,000 pounds of food.
Wow.
It looks like the jungle. We only get water 2 days a week. We're operating on such a minimal level of water that I believe once people look at our numbers, they're gonna change their mindset. And part of that is what's below. The mycorrhizal cultures actually allow for huge drought tolerance and such, because as a web, it kind of holds on to the water and allows the plants to ask for the nutrients that they need.
Well, you know, the predictions of more drought in California, here and many places in the world, are having this issue. With not only that, you know, I'd like to know, you know, you've seen when people start using the water system that goes way down. What's that called? The base water system?
The aquifer.
Which is the aquifer.
The lens.
What do you say about when people start tapping into the aquifer for their farming, like in places in California where they've been doing that?
So, you know, that's a road to disaster, what they have going there in California. Well, I actually did a project in California almost for 2 years. We went there, and we took all the voyaging plants from Hawaii there with us.
Oh, did you?
To show that we could grow everything we grow there, here, there. Actually, there's no fruit fly there. So it was way easier to grow food in California than it was here.
Really?
That doesn't change their water issues. One of the projects I had over there is I have invented an atmospheric watering system where I can take the humidity out of the air.
Atmospheric
watering system.
That's the stuff they show in science sci-fi
movies. Oh, yeah.
Movie.
I'm sort
you
of a
that.
Citizen scientist,
yeah.
If you will. So years ago, I've learned how to actually cool the water down and send it down through the hot field cold within a sleeve, and it condenses the humidity out of the atmosphere. And I can water an entire tree crop just with a solar panel, a thing of cold water, and some pipes.
And the fact that it's creating that from the humidity.
From the humidity that's in the air.
It's which is causing.
We always have like 80% humidity if we're anywhere now near the ocean. So we've proven this system. We've shown that we can water without water. But also, so there's a lot of different models we're trying to put forward. When we were in California, we were also showing people how to turn their swimming pools into aquaponic systems that didn't kill the bees or the native animals. They were able to water all of their landscape with it, as well as grow tons of food.
Well, in other words, you're not going to swim in your pool.
No, they swim in it with the fish.
They would swim in their pool with the fish.
Crystal clear water that you can drink.
I don't think they're going to use chlorine then.
In your swimming pool. So like getting people off the chlorine and letting them realize that there's these different things that exist. At the same time, we'll go back to the worms eating styrofoam. So when I was a kid, I found some worms in some oatmeal at a health food store, a Molokai. I brought it home, and since I was already using all these worms to break down wood chips and all these different things, I threw these worms they were in the oatmeal. I had these worms in a styrofoam container, and I wanted to bring them to my friend to ask him about them. And on the way there, they ate through the styrofoam container. I was just blown away. So I took some old surfboards from a whole nother story in itself that were left with me that were broken at one of our surf spots, and I basically threw them in a container with the worms, and the worms ate them.
They ate
everything
the
except the fiberglass shell.
Unbelievable.
So that started a journey that I'm going on about 15 years now of like how I actually use that along with some fungal material, earthworms as well, creatures.
Were you curious about this? I mean, did you see them actually?
Not only that, we've done a lot of testing, and we know that it's actually Stanford years later did a study on the common mealworm that actually does the same thing. It's able to do it through a bacteria that's in its gut that actually transforms it. It was EPS, expanded epoxy foam, basically. That, if you consider, it's a petroleum product, and there are bacteria that actually eat petroleum.
Wow.
And that's what you hear about an oil spill, them being able to throw a bacteria on it. So, of course, the answers are going to be there in nature already. We just have to start looking to nature for some of the answers instead of just displacing it.
So when you see it in a lot of the places where the sugarcane was growing and they had a lot of plastic in the fields that they've used. We've seen that black plastic in many of the fields. If you start putting more worms in there, will that be able to restore that? Or
unfortunately not. The only thing we can do about the black plastic is pull it out by hand, and we do a lot of that. But it could lead to other developments in the future. There is a waxworm in India that actually eats that type of plastic.
Really?
What I'm talking about is the worms are actually eating styrofoam, which makes a huge amount of our landfills.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like by bulk, not by weight. Yeah. It's crazy.
So can you start putting those worms in the landfill?
We've been going through this process for many years, and again, we don't want to release anything out without crossing all of our T's and dotting our I's. Mm-hmm. What we have done, though, is I've traveled around the world as an athlete for many years and kite surfing, all kinds of different things. And what would happen for a while is I would take my boards, and when they broke, I would put them in a box with the worms, let them eat them. I would time-lapse it so we have video of this. And then I would take that material, process it with fungi, process it with earthworms. And then in a couple instances, we actually grew flax glass and then made boards that were glassed out of the old styrofoam.
What?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's even hard to comprehend.
What?
You can find an article in Surfer Magazine 2018 in October that actually spells that whole process out.
What would you Google that as?
That would be a Surfer Magazine styrofoam eating worms, super worms. And so that for me, being a surfer and
I'm having a flash of Dune. And remember those sandworms?
Yes, they actually look very similar to that, but much smaller. So, like, for me, trying to get my surf community involved with it and going, hey, guys, we have surfboards. We travel all around the world. We should be ambassadors of stewardship if there was anybody.
Yeah.
Look at our ocean. Let's keep our reefs clean.
Yeah.
We have a board made out of styrofoam. How do we deal with that? So that, like, has gone to a lot of things and just trying to bring awareness throughout surfers. I feel like it's our kuleana as surfers, as well as everyone else's, to take care of the planet. But we really better be paying attention to what happens right in the ocean where we enjoy every day.
Well, I saw a movie about this 3 years ago, and it was called, I think, Oceans or Plastic. I forget, but I was blown away, and I saw that the entire ocean system now has plastic everywhere. The entire ocean has plastic throughout every single part of it. That blew my mind. The fish.
Yeah, let me speak on that for just a moment, not to interrupt you.
Yeah,
but
no, go ahead.
Yeah, so a lot of people don't understand what that means. When they think an ocean full of plastic, they think intact jars
tiny.
And this. And so what happens is it actually breaks down into a cloud that we can't even see it with our eyes. It's just a cloud. Now, there are places where it's huge, big pieces still.
Yeah.
But those cloud, actually the really bad part of that is those microparticles are now being ingested by the lowest levels of the food chain. So algae are eating them and being eaten by fish, smaller fish. Larger fish are eating them. So now we've actually shown that we can find PBCs. I don't want to quote the exact word of it, but there's a term for the plastic particles, and they're found in almost every living creature on the planet now.
Yeah.
So, like, where are we going to interrupt that and stop that? I'm constantly... So when I do farm-to-table dinners, we do farm-to-table dinners at our farm because we want to promote people, promote to people what we're doing and turn them on through what they're eating.
You don't serve worms.
No, we don't serve worms.
Okay.
But so for the last one we did, 100% of our plates, our forks, our napkins are all made with paper, unbleached, biodegradable material. So 100% of everything from the event, we feed back to our worms. And then in the next event, we actually serve something grown from the old materials from the last event.
How do people find out about
zero that? Waste events, we call them.
How would people go to that?
So you would just contact us through Living Earth Systems or through .com or Regenerative Education Centers, recenters.org. Either one of those, you can reach out. You can find us on Instagram, Living Earth Systems. And you can reach out and just say, hey, we want to be a part of this. We want to put a group together for our friends, or we want to come learn from you. So
how you've been doing this for a while, you haven't really told a lot of people about it here. I mean, I've kind of heard about you through a few friends, but where are you reaching out to the world? Because you said you've been traveling the world. Is this really?
Yeah, I have models that I've worked on in Australia, South America, Africa.
You just travel there? You have friends there?
I just did quite a bit of kite surfing all around the world.
Uh-huh.
And I was able to actually hook up with a few sponsors that would take me
Billabong.
And put me on trips.
How did you connect with Billabong?
Oh, Billabong is actually through the Sea Trees program. They're amazing. And I spoke of them earlier. They're restoring mangrove forests and coral reefs and just watershed. And they're committed to like making changes globally. And so, again, they had a thing called the Eco Board Project. They were supporting what I was doing with the worms eating styrofoam. Of course they would. And also, they are partnered up with some really good companies and wanting to bring in our surfers and say, hey, this is your kuleana.
Yeah.
You bear some responsibility of what happens in the ocean, so make it your kuleana, your responsibility. That's how we wound up partnered with Billabong in this, and they're doing something great. They want to have their events promote something that will actually help to restore. So actually, for every point that's made in the contest of every heat, the winning heat, every point will go towards 10 square feet of restoration.
Wow.
Through the Billabong Pro that's playing from
now
until the 10th.
Now, is that earth restoration or ocean restoration or water?
That is a combination of both. But what we're working on with this particular thing they're pushing is within the Maliko Gulch and the Laniapoco Farm, where both of them were adjacent to the reef. And you could see before we started this project, there was tons of red dirt flowing out onto the reef.
Oh, yeah.
So we've actually done things to mitigate that. We've pulled trash out. We've planted native species all along the stream bed.
Can you mention a few native species?
Some of the native species are kamani nut. Some of them are milo, ulu, which is a voyaging plant, pili grass, few others on there. Sorry, I'm a little flustered for what we've been talking about so much, but there's a whole list of them that you can find on our website, and you can find on the Sea Trees website as well, at seatrees.org.
And so are you actually able to kind of, on your site that you have, can you videotaped a lot. Have you been able to show what happens as you do this project?
Yes. In fact, we have to be able to show what we're doing. And whenever you're dealing with a nonprofit, you have to be accountable for any money that's come in to support you. So far, this project has been solely funded out of my own pocket for years now. And now we've finally gotten other people to reach out and say, hey, how can we support some of this? So we make a pledge to plant so much around the watershed, and they're putting in a little bit. So people out there in our community can do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You can donate to us directly. You can come be a part of our project, or you can go to the Sea Trees and donate onto something that you know every dollar will basically come out to one sea tree or such.
So,
or 10
so
square feet.
If you wanted to, because I'm going to close out the Facebook.
No problem.
I don't usually this long, but it's so fascinating. This is one of the longer Facebook Lives I've done, but how do people do that and how do they become a part of it? Is that which site do they go to?
So go to seatrees.org and you'll see what to do right when you come up on the page. They have different sites that they do with their program, and you want to look for the Hawaii Watershed Restoration Project.
Wow. Well, I have to say this has truly been unbelievably mind-blowing. We have about 10 minutes left. But I just have to say, this is really something where it's truly educational. What I like is I can feel your passion for what you're doing. And, you know, I love the word enthusiasm, because truly enthusiasm is based on that passion for, in a way, life. It's a passion for God, passion for living. And you have that passion for what you're doing. And I think that's the only way you could be as dedicated as you are to what you're doing. But at the same time, it looks like you have to have a team, because you're growing so fast that there has to be a team. So do you have a team as well involved now?
So I have had several team. It's kind of hard for me to answer that. Yeah, right now, with after COVID, we've lost a lot of our team.
Oh, yeah. You
and a lot of it has just been me by myself.
Wow.
I do have a couple great people working with me. Jesse, I'll shout out to you out there. Scott, I'll shout out to you out there. Kayla. I could go down the list of all people who have been working for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then also we've had some volunteers and a lot of people trying to help push it out there. Zane, a shout out to you and all the help that you've helped to bring our way. So we try to involve our community wherever we can. We're about ready just now to start having some volunteer days.
Mm-hmm.
And again, people will be able to see how they can get involved with these projects by going to the recenters.org website. And they can let us know that they want to be a part of the volunteer program, so we can expand who is involved in this.
I think we'll take a page from George Kahamoko here. He invites people out to see his ranch, his place out there. And next thing you know, they're all working in the garden. He doesn't even ask them. He invites them to come see and visit him, maybe have a lunch. And people don't necessarily know. They're going to be working in that garden for hours till they drop just about it. You know, that's the way to do it. It's a Tom Sawyer kind of approach, right?
Yeah, we haven't really been using that because it's been so specialized.
Uh-huh.
And when people do come, I really have to take the time to educate
them. Well, yeah, it takes time.
So I'm not looking for volunteers that really just want to come help. I want you to come volunteer and I want you to help, but I really want to give to you first and educate to you what we're doing with regenerative agriculture.
Well, yeah, because the more people learn, the more they can share. Wouldn't it be wonderful if some of those people you're teaching, that even the homeschoolers, if they have a group and they taught other people. So, I mean, there's a lot of people, parents who are homeschooling right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that fact that you're doing and allowing the homeschooling parents to come. And how wonderful it is that the kids get to get out They'd much rather do that than be on a computer, right?
That brings me back to your aversion for worms. Kids, I can show you some photos, or if you go to the website, they are all over it.
Really?
You've never seen people cuddle worms like three-year-olds.
Really? Really?
They cuddle them and pet them and
really?
Love them.
Seriously?
And they're so excited to see them.
Wow.
It actually blows my mind how much little girls, 3 to 6 years old, are in love with earthworms right now.
That's amazing.
That like actually kind of stokes me on.
Oh, yeah.
And going, wow, this new generation, they're really into taking care. And they really want to know how to be the best stewards possible on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel lucky just to be able to be in a position to enable them and set them up for success that way.
And the other part is this, again, like you said, anyone can have a garden. I mean, the fact that you have people doing it in a parking lot.
That's right.
And able to start in a parking lot is amazing. And the fact that you can actually have these worms under your sink in the kitchen doing their work there. This is way beyond just composting. That's, almost everyone knows about composting, but they don't know, I'm sure, some of the things that you are saying just about composting. I didn't know about the cardboard. I didn't know about newspapers.
Right.
I never would have guessed newspapers can be turned into soil.
So newspapers are almost pure carbon. When we think of a compost pile and how it works, what we know as composting, and most people really aren't familiar with this, it's known as a chemical process called thermophilic, meaning with heat. So what happens is the direct combination of nitrogen to carbon ratio creates a chemical effect, not a chemical so much, but a chemical effect, meaning that the microbes get so much action going on that it can get as hot as 180 degrees.
My gosh.
That's what's known as hot composting, thermophilic composting. It releases a lot of gases into the atmosphere as well. What we're really trying to teach people is what we call cold, passive composting, where the creatures actually eat it. There is no heat involved.
Uh-huh.
They eat it down and they have certain stuff in their saliva,
how
like
do you
globulin.
Keep it cold? What do you do to
so
keep it from
what,
being
hot? Well, it what makes it hot is a chemical reaction between mm-hmm. nitrogen and carbon, and the creatures are eating it. That process at that rate, them eating it, makes it hot.
Uh-huh.
When that's a different, that's a bacteria.
Uh-huh.
When we actually have an earthworm eating it, there's nothing to get hot. He's chewing on a banana peel. He's spitting it out the other end. Not only is it a cold cast compost that doesn't gas off, it's also a much more stable fertilizer. Their saliva kind of globs it together and holds it under the earth for years and years and years. So they sequester carbon, in a sense, out of the atmosphere and put it in a place where it can serve the land for a millennium.
Well, I love your visions, and I really, really believe, as I'm hearing you talk, that this is going to be not only helpful for what we have in Hawaii, but for the world. And I also sense that it's going to be something that will be used in outer space, and possibly when we go to places like Mars and other places where this could be used to actually change the whole way of existence, right?
I would think so. I would think maybe this is part of our journey into the future. We've done not so great in the last 200 years, just extinguishing all of our resources.
Yeah.
So how do we look to be a little bit more creative, find how nature can serve us as we serve nature, and maybe help us with some of these problems we've created?
Well, we got 1 minute, Eddie, and I just wanted to, again, give you a chance to let people know if they're interested in gardening, if they're interested in volunteering and learning, if they're interested in learning about how they could donate as well, give people the best way to contact you.
So the best way to contact us is recenters.org, just like it sounds.
R-E-centers.
No periods, no hyphenations, mm-hmm. recenters.org, mm-hmm. and that stands for Regenerative Education Centers here on Maui. We're a functioning 501(c). And that's the best way you can get to us. If you want to support the Sea Trees program we're mm-hmm. in, that is seatrees.org.
S-S-E-A.
S-E-A, seatrees.org. And you go to their site, find us on there, and you can donate through that as well. You can also watch the Billabong Pro that's playing from now through February 10th, and you can see what's happening there, and they'll also give you some ways to reach us as well.
I have been so educated, and I tell you something, my whole mind is just thinking in a whole different way than it's ever thought before, about worms for sure, you know, and about the earth, and about carbon, and about how we can change the whole planet. And I just have to say a big, 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 big mahalo to you, Eddie. I appreciate your knowledge and your service.
Thank you for having me here. I'm glad to have the pleasure to share it with everyone. Aloha.
Aloha.